Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, the evolutionary success of humankind has relied on a handful of fundamental but often unsung food and drink developments. Here's a short list. Salt, the domestication of plant species, the flint axe, the invention of irrigation, the potato, fermentation, domestication of animals, Jethro Tull's seed drill, pickling. I mean, there's a few of them, but they're the fundamentals. Now, one development that's rarely discussed, which is strange because it's so important, is the domestication, if that's the right word, of ice. Which is odd, because when you take a closer look at it, ice is fascinating. So sit back and chill out, because we're going to take you through a short history of ice with the brilliant writer Fred Hogg, whose book Of Ice and Men, How We've Used Cold to Transform Humanity, is published in February 2023. Fred, welcome to the podcast. Congratulations on your book. It's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you so much, Stefan, and thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Ah, it's just brilliant to have you here. Now, you moved from London to Thailand a couple of years ago. Now, Thailand is hot. I live in London. I am jealous because London is cold. So, why write about ice? I mean, it's Schadenfreude, isn't it?
Well, I need to tell you first off, at this time of the year, Thailand, particularly the north of Thailand where I am, is cold.
Yeah, right. You're just making me feel good, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I literally, when I got up this morning to go and make the tea, I was shivering in the kitchen, actually shivering.
Okay.
And I write about the mechanics of how the body gets cold at the beginning of the book. And I was in the first stage at the kettle this morning, literally shaking. And up here, I mean, you know, we're in the Northern Hemisphere. And our highest mountain, Doi Intanon, gets serious frost and snowfall at this time of the year. So we're not completely immune to the cold.
Yeah, you're clutching at straws. You're being kind to me. So if not just to make me feel bad, why ice? I mean, you know, you're a scriptwriter. You've done all sorts of extraordinary writing projects. I'm just wondering why ice. What kicked you into action with ice?
Well, I suddenly realized through some cocktail work and other things that ice is this big, and not just ice itself, but that everything that ice gives us, refrigeration, air conditioning, all these things, ice is the big undiscussed technology that has allowed us as an animal to explode as a creature over the last 70 years. It has transformed us in ways that are remarkable. And broadly transformed us in just by the sheer numbers of who we are. And then you start saying, well, when did we start using it? When did ice become a thing? And you start trying to claw through the history, and then you discover, oh my gosh, this is actually something that's been going on for generations. And that was really fascinating. Ice first appears in the historical record before we actually consider history to be history. It first occurs in what you'd probably call proto-history. So there is writing, but nobody's writing history itself.
Right.
It first crops up, of all places, in ancient Sumer, which is what we would now call Iraq.
You'd expect Sumer to be hot.
Yes, you would. The birthplace of civilization, in the very first city of Uruk. We have a tablet that's written in the year 13 of the reign of Shulgi. And year 13 of the reign of Shulgi is the year of the ice house. That's the year they built their first ice house to store, well, ice. And this is about 5,000 years ago or thereabouts. A very long time. And humans have been using ice since the very beginning of civilization. Which is a remarkable thing.
It's So while we in Britain were building Stonehenge, they were already on ice houses.
This is way before Stonehenge. But yes, you know, they already were building ice houses. I mean, gosh, I'm trying to remember the age of Stonehenge right now. My historical knowledge is of British prehistory is slipping slightly. I've not been working on that for a while. But yeah, it's a while before Stonehenge. Certainly by the time of the next historical marker that we have, which was a civilization, let me just reach for the book here because I can't quite remember. I think it's called the Mari.
No, I do exactly the same thing. Once I've written a book and I do an interview, it's like, no, I wrote that a year and a half ago.
Well, I'm trying to work on the pitch for the next one right now, Steph, and so I'm forgetting some of this stuff. But yes, the civilization called Mari, which was based around near about the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor on the banks of the Euphrates, they had ice houses too, and they had a connection with a rook. But they are about concurrent with Stonehenge.
Yeah. So the Sumerians, so that's the first time it's mentioned, where ice houses are mentioned.
Yes.
Why did they value ice? Was it just a luxury good? Was it a novelty, or was it something that was sort of needed?
Well, this is a really good question. The answer is we just don't know at this period of time, because what's going on then is we have this fundamental problem with the deep past of textual transmission. So when you're looking at Sumeria, there is an enormous amount of information written down on the clay tablets in cuneiform. But we only know what we know from the tablets that survive. Millions of other tablets that don't come down must have been ground into dust. Mm-hmm. And we just don't get that information because of that. Similarly, it happens with books as well. If you look at the classical period, the Greco-Roman period, one of my favorite examples is the poet Catullus. Catullus comes down to us because, as far as I understand it, a copy of his book was found under a barrel sometime in the 12th or 13th century. And that's the only reason why we have Catullus, who's a fantastic poet. I mean, yes, a little bit racy, a little bit ooh, a little bit way. but, you know, we wouldn't have him but for that copy being found in that circumstance.
Yeah.
There are,
I guess,
so
the same
many,
goes for the Bible, doesn't it? Yeah.
The same exactly goes for the Bible. And, you know, you can't get back to those early copies of Mark or Luke and even the Apocrypha, which is the crazy part of the Bible that we don't talk about because it's a bit too out there.
Racy, once again, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, there's so many books of Livy that don't survive. There's an historian whom I adore called Cassius Dio, who is a Greek who wrote about Roman history in the 3rd century. We have about... He wrote something like 70 books of history, and we only have about 20. And then the last few that are lost survive in this epitomized form, and they're really shit.
So let's get back to the ice for a second. So
do we know?
You get, but the, I mean, this is what's exciting about the book, though, because it's about storytelling as well. But let's get on to that in a little while. First of all, let's get to grips a little bit more with when we sort of started kind of valuing ice and when it became a luxury. Do we know when humans started making ice rather than just storing it?
We started making ice in the 19th, 20th century. But we started valuing ice very much earlier. Mm-hmm. Because to make ice, you need to understand how heat exchange works. You need to understand thermodynamics. And for a very long time in history, of course, we didn't. But ice was valued. We've been talking about Sumeria earlier on in this conversation. But we know that ice was being brought down into markets in ancient Athens in the 5th century. We know that ice was being brought down into the markets of ancient Rome in the 1st centuries AD and BC. And on through that, we know that ice had enormous value. But this ice had to be harvested. People had to go out and gather it and then bring it down off mountaintops. to people. And generally at this point, we're not talking about a hard, big block of ice. We're talking about compacted snow.
Yeah.
And compacted snow is not the best product for cooling things because it has a lot of dirt in it. And so we do have records from Roman sources about how to buy your snow and then place a pitcher with water in it so that the water will freeze within the snow, and then you have clean ice that you can then use to chill wine.
Yeah.
We have that evidence. So ice at this point, and the snow that's collected, it has huge value because of the amount of labor that's required to gather it.
And that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because the stuff itself is just water. At that time, water's free. It's not quite free now, but it's not far off. And so it's all about the labour and the technology surrounding the product rather than the product itself.
So when it first starts to be traded properly at the beginning of the 19th century, it's this guy from Boston called Frederick Tudor who hits upon this idea of, we have loads of ice here in New England. Let's sell it to the tropics. And so he hits on this idea of shipping ice from New England to the Caribbean. And the first year in which he does it, 1806, he goes to Martinique. He's got a ship full of ice, which survives the journey in very good condition. And he sells it basically off the dock. And there's this apocryphal story of him selling some to this guy. And the guy goes away and then comes back and says, you sold me this thing and there's nothing here, because it had melted. But Tudor is the first person to make ice cream in the Caribbean. And basically he is the key linchpin person who changes the human relationship with ice. He's the one who takes it from a luxury product that only the rich can afford to chill their drinks in the summer, yada, 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 and makes it an everyday commodity. And he's a remarkable character.
And when you're telling the story of this, I started off thinking, is this title of Ice and Men just a nice bit of wit? Is it Fred just being a bit clever? And then I realised as you go through it that you're binding these things together, because this is it's not a valueless thing, but the stuff itself is free. It's about the stories around it, and therefore about the men who Tudor made fortunes and lost them, as you tell in the story, and his story gets bound up with all these other developments. So why do you say that this was an enabler of sort of population growth? Why was ice itself fundamental to humankind?
Well, this is about nutrition. Bottom line, when you have cold storage, you have access to a better quality of food. And that's what people realized very, very quickly. And when Frederick Tudor first started doing his ice trading, I don't think he had any idea about how people could ship food across the world using his product and everything else. I don't think most innovators, when they have a brilliant idea to do a thing like, I'm going to sell ice to the Caribbean and India and the world and make it work, there are all these corollaries that come along with it. And I think that was the most important thing. The corollaries with Tudor was a guy like John Gorrie down in California, who would buy ice and sling it in hammocks over malaria patients because he was a tropical diseases doctor. And that led him into thinking about refrigeration and all the rest of it. Mm. Other people did the same thing in railway cars. And then they suddenly realized that they could ship food over long distances because there was ice there cooling the vegetables or the meat. So Tudor did not anticipate any of this stuff. But what he did anticipate and what he did understand was domestic food provision. And certainly when he started selling ice to Savannah and to Charleston, he innovated his first ice boxes. So prototype fridges where you had a cabinet, and the very top part of the cabinet had a space where you would put a block of ice, and then you could keep food cool underneath it. Mm. So you store your milk, you could store fish, you could store butter, you could store meat. for longer than you normally would have been able to in those environments without. And suddenly, this begins a process of allowing us as an animal better access to nutrition. And this begins to change us. There's this whole sort of theory about the baby boom. And people always say that the baby boom was down to GIs coming home from the war to their wives, like Ulysses is to their Penelopes, and making babies. When you look at the statistics, this actually isn't true. Non-commissioned people in the United States who didn't go off to war were having children at just the same rate as returning GIs. And there is a Nobel Prize winning economist called Gary Becker, who worked on this in the mid-60s, 1965. And he basically said, no, it's not about people coming back from the war, it's about fridges. Mm. And he called it appliance fertility.
Brilliant.
The theory goes that because of the fridge, it becomes a massively labor-saving device in the process of child rearing. So therefore, people have access to good quality food, which for the first part makes them healthier, which makes them more likely to bring a child to term alive and in good condition, and it makes it easier for that child to be nourished and raised. Childbearing is the most dangerous thing that you can do in human history. It's more dangerous than war. Having a baby is a massively dangerous, awful thing. And as guys, we generally don't understand that idea. You know, for a woman to commit to having a baby is an she's risking her life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's not as dangerous as it was now, but it's a hugely dangerous thing. The other factor is that before all this nourishment became available, and also the concomitant medicine that goes along with refrigeration, which we'll come on to in a second, kids died. It was really hard to make it out of childhood. That's why, you know, you look at gravestones and there are like 17 kids dead in the same grave as their mum, and three of them may have made it to adulthood. Childhood was dangerous. It was really hard to make it out of childhood before these advances in nutrition. And one has to park this improvement in nutrition squarely at the door of the refrigerator. As B. Wilson brilliantly wrote, the fridge is the new hearth around which the home operates. It changes everything.
And it changes our relationship with food as well, doesn't it?
Completely. And that means that we are able to make more of us. And it's no accident that, therefore, when you look at 1950, there were like 1.2 billion of us on the planet. Today, there are over 8 billion humans on the planet. And it is in no small part down to how we've used the cold. Mm. And 8 billion is a terrifying number.
And it's surprisingly recent as well. And you talk in the book about the development of the first fridges. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay, so the fridge, the domestic refrigerator was invented, depending on your source, between 1914 and 1916. And there are several guys who invented fridges around the same time. And was generally supported by car manufacturers, as it turns out. A lot of car manufacturers got behind these early fridge guys, created companies like Frigidaire. But their big problem was that the fridges were powered by gases that were incredibly toxic. And so fridges killed people. If a seal broke, your fridge would totally. This is your 1920s refrigeration nightmare.
Not a good look.
Not a good look. So even Albert Einstein got involved in trying to solve this particular problem. But the guy who really came up with the solution to our detriment in the long run, though we didn't know at the time, was a man named Thomas Midgley. And Thomas Midgley was a chemist who had previously solved the problem of engine knocking by inventing leaded petrol. It's something that ultimately killed a lot of people.
Mm. Swings and roundabouts.
Swings and roundabouts. And his solution for finding an inert gas that would not kill people if the seals broke was CFCs. So he basically invented CFCs, which, as we now know, break down ozone in the upper atmosphere in a way that's actually really harmful to us. Now, in Midgley's defense, I write in the book that he's the man who's probably killed more people than anyone who hasn't started a war. Which, and I don't mean to be unfair to the man. He's an award-winning chemist. And when he came up with CFCs, he had no idea.
Yeah.
Though with the leaded petrol thing, he actually did. Because he got sick from the lead himself.
Yeah.
With the CFCs, he is broadly blameless. He thought this was a perfectly inert solution. He did a whole press conference where he breathed the stuff in and then blew out a candle. And he had no idea that what he had invented was going to cause so much trouble later on. But it was a brilliant solution. And it allowed fridges to function without killing their owners, which I think we can both agree is a good thing.
Bonus.
And that started putting fridges into more and more and more houses. And it's one of the surprising things about the 1930s. We think about the Great Depression and everyone having no money, which is true, unless they were heiresses in the movies, like It Happened One Night. But people were buying fridges in the United States. They were buying a lot of fridges. And America basically becomes the first refrigerated society. This isn't my line. I wish I could remember the name of the writer who wrote it right now, and I can't, and I'm sorry about that.
We'll give it to you then, Fred. That's fine.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. But America became rapidly refrigerated, and you had trains trucking meat out of the meatpacking districts of Chicago, where all the beef would go to be slaughtered to cup up. You had trains trucking incredible produce out of California, which had been advertised at this point as the cornucopia of the West for its enormously fertile lands. You had potatoes coming out of Idaho and being shipped across the states to, you know, these are all in refrigerated rail cars. And this is way before we in Europe really start getting in on the game. At this point, our refrigeration is really only in industry. It's in brewing, it's in fish, it's in dairy. It's really not in the home.
But driven by the food and drink industry?
Yes, very much so. Because the medical industry hasn't really caught up to this yet.
Yeah.
The early vaccines are not necessarily stored in fridges.
So we've talked about a couple of double-edged swords here. Now, the fridge is fantastic, as you quoted B. Wilson. You know, it's the hearth, the new hearth. It's like the new fireplace of the kitchen.
Exactly.
But it is a double-edged sword, I guess. It's because now, these days, we rely on fridges to keep our food healthy for us to eat, to sort of stop bacterial growth. But people don't really necessarily know how to use a fridge that well. And it's now a relatively sort of potent source of bacteria and sort of contamination. So I've done my level 2 in food and hygiene, you see, a little online course. And a lot of that is about where you put food in the fridge. Now, if you put your raw meat or products that...
You're going to have to do the talking now because you're onto topics that I don't know.
Have you not done your level 2 diploma, Fred?
I have not, Stefan. I'm so sorry.
It's all about placing food in the fridge. So basically anything that's mainly meats, obviously, that might drip
you
blood.
Should probably put it at the bottom.
Put it at the bottom, that's right. And anything that is is not going to be cooked before it's eaten goes above that, you see. And this is one of those things, it's very difficult for the authorities to really work it out, but they reckon that thousands of deaths every year, and certainly millions of illnesses, are caused by bad fridge planning. So this is just one of the double-edged swords that I wonder sort of are
fridge planning
buried, yeah, fridge planning buried in refrigeration and within ice. Now, what are the other negatives about the ubiquity of ice now and refrigeration? Is that a double-edged sword? Are there parts of it where you go, okay, wasn't quite as good as all that?
In and of itself, I don't think there's a downside to fridges. However, there is a downside in the sense, and we talked about this briefly earlier on, I know you want to come on to ice and climate change later on in this conversation. The downside is that it has created so many more of us. 8 billion people is an enormous number.
Yeah.
And it, when, you know, you walk out your lovely front door in North London and step down the street, I imagine that you have no conception of the idea of an impact that you could possibly have upon a planet, because you're just one guy with a wonderful wife and wonderful children. How can we possibly affect this enormous world upon which we live? And I think most people feel that way. I know I do. Mm. And, you know, we're told that we should recycle, we should do this, we should do that, and we do. But then you think, how am I possibly causing what these scientists are telling me are happening? And the fact of the matter is there are now 8 billion of us on the world. And anyone who has listened to the Frank Sinatra song, High Hopes, understands how a tiny creature like an ant can move a rubber tree plant. There are so many of us now that we have an impact. And this is the fundamental idea that we need to get on board with. It's not just about you, Stefan, and me, Fred. It's about the fact that we are both one each of 8 billion, and we have to try and deal with this idea, which is, I think, enormous. The other factor as well, I think, and this is really difficult, is the idea of climate change has been around us now for a very long time. And I think that there is a level where it's become a certain amount of white noise. Because, you know, we've been talking about this since the 80s. I remember talking, being brought up when I was at school in the 80s, that certainly when it first became a viable political thing, and the science has been well established since the 1960s, but the problem is there's no real and immediate scary threat.
Yeah.
This is ultimately I genuinely believe as a result of domestic fridges is that there are now, as a result of us having fridges in so many homes, there are now so many of us. We, as an animal, unless we do something about it, which we can, we are a clear and present danger to our own ecosystem. Mm. And I think that this is something that we need to engage with and attack, because the prospects, it's a bell curve. As I think you know, these things, it's like the thing that Nick, the character in the Hemingway book, The Sun Also Rises, I went broke gradually and then I went broke suddenly. These things happen gradually and then suddenly we go up. Mm. And once we start crossing that threshold where things start to go up faster, we can't turn them back. So it's a question of what are we prepared to do as a species globally to try and arrest that bell curve before it gets out of control. And this is the thing that you asked a question on the list of on the thing that you sent me earlier on about what's the one thing every nonfiction book has, one fact that gets the author ridiculously excited. Well, this is one nonfiction book where the author gets ridiculously scared. I've known about climate change since I was a school kid. I'm 50 years old. I've known about this since I was at school. We as an animal have done nothing about it. People go to COP26 that we had in Glasgow, was it last summer?
Yes, that's right.
Nothing happened. Bunch of people sat around, they put a load of hot air into the atmosphere, they did nothing. They may have made an agreement about an idea. There was no action, there was nothing concrete, there was nothing real. And you look back to the Montreal Protocol that dealt with the CFCs that Thomas Midgley invented back in the 30s, and this was 1989. The Montreal Protocol brought together two superpowers that hated each other, the USSR and the USA, and everybody else, into one place in Canada. They came to an agreement. They said, this is fucking frightening. We're going to deal with this. And they did. That whole thing was enacted by 1991. CFCs now are incredibly underused. The whole, as they call it, in the ozone layer, is now smaller today than it was when it was pointed out in the mid-80s. This is a result of climate legislation that actually worked. Nobody has done anything like it since. And this is horrific because we have the tools to do it. We could do a thing on methane tomorrow. Methane is a massive climate change gas. On the good side, it breaks down enormously more quickly than carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide takes about 100 to 300 years to break down. Methane takes about 30 years to break down in the atmosphere. It leaks out of old coal mines. It leaks out of badly insulated gas lines. And it comes out of the tundra. Tundra we can't fix. The other three we can. And we're not doing it. Methane has not been a factor in any COP conference.
So the interesting thing about these issues is that a lot of the developments of refrigeration, of ice houses, of the stuff itself have been economic. It's been about making a buck, sometimes making an impression, but making a buck. Now, I mean, the same thing, presumably, if you want to have the same sort of level of innovation, then people need to be able to make a buck about it with solving the problems it's created at the same time, I guess. And that's where there's often a gap. You know, when America and the USSR got together, they solved that problem. But I wonder if the scale of things now mean that there has to be a financial imperative to mitigate the things that we've done that caused us our success, that have now potentially, you know, are causing our downfall. And so do you think it's incumbent upon people who use refrigeration, i.e. me, you, but also the food industry, to come up with solutions, or is population growth and technological advance a joint endeavour and that really needs to be done, you know, controlled by governments rather than by individuals?
I think this is a really interesting and very difficult question. I mean, this is an economic question, and I don't think either of us are economists. Although, I don't know. Maybe you have a secret ace up your sleeve.
But you're the Iceman, so I wonder if there's a connection there somewhere.
I think any economist would say that incentive is key to a lot of things. I think that in our world of food and of drinks, if we can educate, we should educate, while also serving delicious things, because that's our job, ultimately. And, you know, we're in the food and drinks world. We exist to make someone the most delicious icy drink they can, the most fantastic plate of food, be it vegan, vegetarian, or full-on carnivore, that they can enjoy. But if, while we do that, we can educate people, I think that we do have a role to play. And the place that I think that it exists to play is in trying to tell people about food chains and how food gets from A to B. And I think that which is one of the brilliant things that refrigeration has given us. I mean, I have always been fascinated by going into the supermarket and seeing, you know, green beans from Kenya. In a weird way, that's always fascinated me more than bananas from St. Lucia or Jamaica, because, you know, my mother's from Jamaica and I know about banana boats, and you cut your green bananas, you put them on the boat, you ship them to Britain, and by the time they arrive, they're broadly ripe, and that's okay. The green bean is a whole different ballgame. I mean, these guys, they're growing on their little vine in Kenya, and somebody snips them off, puts them in a bag, and literally, inside 36 to 48 hours, they're in your Waitrose, or your Tesco's, or your Sainsbury's, and this is remarkable. And people don't understand how this works. And I think that it's important. I mean, the idea of strawberries in January in British supermarkets is something that I have always found genuinely baffling. They just shouldn't be there. We shouldn't have, you know, strawberries are supposed to be a treat that come in at the end of May, the beginning of June. They're not supposed to be there. But we have them, and that has an impact upon our world and the environment upon which we live, and that therefore affects us concomitantly as an animal. And I think we need to be talking more about how that process works and why we do it.
And seasonality is a fundamental part of a lot of cuisine now already, and it would be great if that was extended. I mean, choice is wonderful, but as you say, the fundamental point about a delicious strawberry is the fact that you haven't had it all winter, and it's suddenly there, and then it's that much more delicious. So I guess, you know, that the choices about food that we make are a huge part of the impact of our CO2 equivalent emissions.
It kicks into all of that stuff. And it's not just CO2, it is also methane, it's also other gases. Agriculture on this level has a massive impact upon the world around us. And we're always trying to find the next get out of jail thing with this, whether it was the brilliant short wheat that they came up with in the 60s, the name of which I can't remember, or the new wheat I read in the paper today that they've just developed, that can apparently survive drought, and they're about to plant all over southern Spain to see if it really actually works and they've got it right. You know, we're always trying to find the next get out of jail free thing. And it comes back down to the same horrible fact. There are just too many of us. And what ethically can we do about that? It's not like, you know,
the trickiest one, isn't it?
We can't do the whoops apocalypse solution where you've got Peter Cook standing on the edge of Beachy Head lining people up to throw themselves over it, saying thank you so much for your contribution as they all hurl themselves to their doom to deal with population. We can't do that. It's absolutely immorally wrong, but we have to come up with something.
I mean, a lot of people say that increased wealth and fairness in societies mean that people don't have to have such enormous families, i.e. to look after them economically later on. So there we go. Just make everyone a little bit wealthier and a little bit less in need, and it'll all be fine.
I think and hope that might be true. Much trickier to get there.
Let's go back to the last couple of questions about ice. Now, one of the interesting things, I think, that just one of the little facts that I picked up when I was reading the book was the relationship between the UK and Norway in terms of shipping ice around. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's just a little nugget that I thought was fascinating.
Of course. Well, the Norway-UK ice trade began formally in 1824. And a guy called William Lethwich started shipping ice from Norway to stock ice cellars in London to supply ice to polite society. What's really interesting about this is that he wasn't the first to do it. There were very celebrated confectioners who had a shop in Berkeley Square called Gunther and Negri, who had been there since at least the 1760s. And they were famous for making ice cream, and they were getting their ice from somewhere. But we don't know where, because nobody writes this shit down. For some reason, they don't find it as interesting as you and I. So Gunther and Negri were getting their ice from somewhere, and the person who got closest to finding out where was the fabulous and celebrated food writer Elizabeth David. He was a big hero to many of us. And it seems that they would have a certain amount of ice that they managed to harvest in the winters of between January and February and March. You could get decent ice out of ponds and all the rest of it. It was of good quality. But this would sometimes run out. But then what do you do? If you run out of the ice that you've harvested that particular winter, where do you go? And the answer is you send a whaling ship to an iceberg. And Elizabeth David recounts a particular story of a ship called, I think, the Platoff, that lands in the port of London sometime in the very late 1700s. And the customs officers don't know what to do with the cargo of ice because there's no port of embarkation. And they say, well, we don't know how to tax this. What do we do? And it's like, there is no import park of importation. This came out of an iceberg in the middle of the North fucking Atlantic. What do you want to do for nothing? So that one unfortunately melts. They never get that one out of bond. Eventually, the customs department figures out a way of working this around, and they're able to import ice. But William Lethwich is very much picking up on the Frederick Tudor guy that we talked about earlier, who's shipping ice out of Boston from 1806, and he starts shipping ice from Norway. And around the following year, a company from America that's not Tudor, but another operation, starts selling ice called the Wenham Lake Ice Company. And they open a shop on the Strand. And they, every day, they would put a big block of ice in behind the window for people to look at with a copy of the Times behind it so that people could read the newspaper through the ice. And sometimes they would choose to put a block of ice with a fish in it. And even though the ice industry never really took off in the UK in the same way they did in the States, as much as these guys tried, they did well enough that a bunch of Norwegian exporters petitioned the Norwegian king to change a particular lake in Norway, to change its name to Wenham, so they could say Wenham Lake Ice, because the brand stuck. And the Norwegian king said yes, and they did. I don't know if this is a full answer to your question.
It's just extraordinary that there was a trade between Norway and the UK of just shipping thousands of tons of ice every year.
Thousands of tons, but it was nowhere near on the scale of the American ice trade. New York alone was consuming 4 million tons of ice, as did the Australians, who were amongst the first inventors of artificial cooling systems for breweries. You know, these refrigeration systems were as big as a house. So you could put them in a brewery, you could put them in a ship, but you couldn't use them as a domestic thing. But that was...
Not in your cottage.
No. No, but this is where the phrase, do you fancy a cold one, mate?
Yeah,
begins.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a massive, massive operation. Germany was taking ice from Norway as well, but they, by the late 1800s as well, were beginning to use artificial ways of cooling to make their beer cold. Mm. Was it Karl Linder was the big German scientist who was behind a lot of this, and he was hired by the Guinness family to help their brewery and put the carbon dioxide at the right pressure into their stout. So that was a big factor.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, time is dripping through our fingers like a melting cube of ice. So just a couple of little questions. Your relationship with cocktails is legendary. Can you tell us about your favourite cocktail where ice is fundamental to the enjoyment? And why is that?
Well, ice is fundamental to every cocktail apart from the hot ones. I would suggest to you, my good friend Stefan, that you cannot have a cocktail without ice. Unless you're making a hot buttered rum or a hot whiskey toddy or an Irish coffee, you have to have ice. And ice, this is where the book starts for me. The whole genesis of the book is, how does ice get into the cocktail? Which is a question that we cannot answer. Although I would reckon sometime around the 1820s, when ice started being exported into New Orleans, would be my go-to point.
But the interesting thing about ice drinks is that it's kind of counterintuitive in sort of sensory perception terms, because when you cool something, you suppress some of the odours. So what's the magical bit that the ice gives?
That's a really good question that I've never actually thought about.
It's so fundamental to cocktails, though, isn't it?
Ice does suppress odour. It does, you know, if you overchill a white wine, you lose a lot of its aromatics. Mm. I was weirdly here in Chiang Mai at a very lovely French restaurant we like to go called La Terrasse, and I had a glass of red wine and it came out of the fridge, and when it was poured on our first sip, all I could taste were the tannins because it was so cold. All of the other things were completely sat upon by the sheer act of cooling. So that is a factor. However, when you are in a hot place, the act of having a cool drink is cooling in and of itself.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that most whiskies and rums and other things, for all their flavor characteristics, which I know that we could go into in an enormous amount of detail, don't have quite the same aromatic qualities as a wine. So by chilling them down, you're not losing a huge amount, but also you are refreshing the customer who wants to be cooled in a hot day, particularly in the 18-somethings when people are wearing far too many clothes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, yeah, they've got those coats and those hats and those big neck chiefs and stuff. We've seen the costume dramas. We know what they were wearing. I mean, my gosh, these people must have been melting.
It's basically a way of sorting out your BO, isn't it? Okay, we have run out of time now. So just very quickly, what is... You've done ice. You've covered ice marvellously. I have to say, it's fantastic. What's your next project? What are you hoping to do next?
I would like to be writing about the intersection between history and myth.
Mm-hmm. Which is so much about your book. It's actually about storytelling, isn't it? Your the ice book.
Well, that's what I'm interested in, is storytelling.
Okay, so just very lastly then, give us a 10-second plug for your book. Why should we go and buy Of Ice and Men?
Because you get to go from the ancient Sumerians through to guys who are chilling people down in emergency surgery to save their lives. This is the past of the future in one thing.
Beautiful. I love that. Okay, that will do. Fred Hogg, you have been an absolutely brilliant guest. Rambling, but brilliant, which is exactly what I hope
for. I'm sorry, I do ramble. Kay gets so cross with me. I'm terrible at digressing.
That's absolutely perfect. I love it. Well, I hope you'll run out and buy a copy of the brilliant Of Ice and Men, which is out in February 2023. And Fred Hogg, thank you so much for joining me.
Stefan, thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure. Now, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.